Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to Live Up to Freedom Radio, hosted by Annie Cyrus.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for joining me on Live Up to Freedom Radio today, Monday, September 13. Before we bring on our very special guest today, I just want to remind everybody that we did have a very special programming for September 11, which was Saturday. It was a four-hour broadcast. Just in case if you missed it and you didn't get the notification, the link to the video is available on liveuptofreedom.com. And as you know, if you are part of the website, you know, there's a lot more that has been uploaded on the website. So make sure to check out liveuptofreedom.com. Sign up for our newsletter and text alert system so you don't miss future broadcasts, radio, or videos. Today, however, we are going to talk about something that I have not heard many people talk about. We all, including myself, we have covered Afghanistan, Taliban, Iran, China, Russia, America, within the disaster that has been created by Biden administration in the last couple of weeks. But today we're going to concentrate on how it is affecting and it's going to affect and it has been affecting Israel. On that note, it is my privilege to have with me today on this program Isaac Kite. He is a freedom-loving truth teller. He's the host of the podcast Inside Israel News. Hello, Isaac.
Hi, Annie. How are you?
I am hanging in there, but very excited to have you on. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Let's start from here, Isaac. Go ahead and tell our listener a little bit about yourself, about your podcast, about where people can find you. So before we get heated into the discussion, everybody already took a note of Vertigo.
Sure. Inside Israel News podcast is available on Apple, Spotify, and all the major podcast services that we use out there. So you can find it there. Also, you can find it on Anchor, who hosts my podcast. Years ago, I served, I earned my MBA in Israel, and I had an opportunity to volunteer in the Israeli Knesset. And over the years since then, all my friends kept, you know, calling me every once in a while, emailing, messaging, hey, what's going on in Israel? What's up with the politics? And finally, I thought, you know, I really should just have a podcast where I can explain to people from an insider's point of view what's going on. And that way they have a better idea. But there's so few people over here who understand how parliamentary governments work, let alone multi-party proportional systems. It gets kind of complicated, so I try to give people an idea of who are the background, who are the personalities, how does the government work, and then kind of go over the news and how that plays into everything. But it's a lot of fun, and I've been able to tell a lot of truth. I've been surprised it's also become something of a platform to fight anti-Semitism, even though my main goal was just to go after the news for Israel, but I've been able to set the record straight and fight the bad guys kind of all at once.
Well, I appreciate you doing it, but I just to add to something you said a lot of people here don't understand how the government works over there. Let's be honest, a lot of people in America don't even know how the government works inside America. I think that's part of the reason we're in trouble that we are today.
Yes, yes. When I was in high school, just like everybody else, they gave us the citizenship test, and I was the first student in the class who passed it and aced it. I was the only student who ever knew all the answers, and it had never happened in my high school history, and of course, all of the kids in the class failed it, but one or two of us, but I was the first one to ace it, and I was so shocked. I mean, it's all such simple knowledge to know. You know, who's the president, who's the vice president, things like this. I mean, we should understand how our system works, or rather, right now, how it doesn't work. But, yes, it's important to have some of the details and the structures of why this is happening and why that is happening. One of the things I appreciated about the previous president was that when President Trump was asked to do certain things, like, oh, why don't you sign an executive order doing this, or why don't you do that? He would explain to people that, hey, we have a federal system. It's up to the governors to do that, or it's not my power, you know? And you'd school even our own media on what the powers of the presidency are in, you know, in perspective. So that was always amusing.
Very true. And main thing, to me, it's just this simple. The government works for us, we the people. That's something that seems to have faded away in many households, that they actually truly think that we have to listen to the government because they are the government. I'm like, no. We the people hold the power, for now at least, until, you know, we just don't do anything about it, and then they will at some point hold the power because they're going to get rid of our constitution. But for now,
we hold the power. Until we go and protest against them, and then all of a sudden we're terrorists, you know, like January 6th. I mean, you know, just people out holding signs, and now we're terrorists, right?
Oh, yeah. We marked a worse day than September 11th on January 6th. I can't believe some of them had the nerves to say such thing, to compare January 6th to September 11th of 2001. Unbelievable. But for our listeners, sorry, I forgot to do this. I was very excited to bring Isaac on. If you have any questions for me or Isaac today, you can call in. The number to call in is 516-453-9075. If you want to come on, press 1 so I know you are waiting to come on and ask a question or if you have a comment. Now, let's get it started, Isaac. Let's do this. Let's give a little bit of history because I'm very happy that I do have a lot of younger generation as listeners to my radio. On that note, we both know there's a good number out there who were either born after September 11, or they were really babies when September 11 happened. And, of course, our mainstream media erased it, and Democrats tried to erase it. So let's go back all the way to the 90s and talk a little bit about, you know, the 90s and the Taliban and Bin Laden and all that good stuff for a few minutes.
Absolutely. You know, in the 80s, the U.S. supported the Mujahideen in their war against the Soviet Union for the obvious reason. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan, and it was a unique opportunity for America to Vietnam, in quotation marks, the Soviet Union, kind of give back as we had been given. So we supplied through third parties, second parties, you know, to the Mujahideen, and they fought the Soviets. After that war ended, Afghanistan was in chaos. It had all these different warlords and war, you know, all these groups. And I remember, you know, speaking of being young, being in high school, and I received one particular copy of The Economist magazine. It was always my favorite back then. It's become something of a rag these days, which is sad. But, you know, I'm reading through it, and it started talking about this new group that had formed in southern Afghanistan called the Taliban, and that this group was largely Pashto. There's many ethnic groups in Afghanistan. It's kind of a hodgepodge there. But it talked about how this group was shutting down schools for girls, literally beating up teachers, especially female teachers, and a lot of teachers just vanished, never to be heard or seen again. And that they were pressing a very extreme version of Islam. It's not so extreme, but I mean, let's, you know, stick to the point here. The Taliban was wanting to go all the way back to the 14th century, and we're looking at this from a Western point of view in the 90s, and nobody cared, nobody knew about it, right? Nobody paid any attention until the Taliban blew up some Buddhist statues, these just absolutely priceless history that they blew up with those statues. And then some people started to notice, oh, hey, there are these Taliban and they're bad guys. Obviously, the Taliban began to grow in power in Afghanistan and take over the rest of the country, and the Northern Alliance was formed among mostly Afghanistan's other ethnic groups to fight back, led by Ahmad Massoud. And they had this conflict going on. Massoud was assassinated 2 days before 9/11. He went to meet with the Taliban ostensibly to talk about some kind of peace arrangement or something, and they killed him, right? So they knew something big was coming even then, right? So, well, we didn't know about 9/11. No, they knew. The Taliban knew what was going on, and they had bin Laden and his training camps there in Afghanistan. They knew what Al-Qaeda was up to, and they deliberately killed their opposition leader just before the 9/11 attacks, knowing that the U.S. was going to respond. So this is the Taliban, right? And I posted a video not too long ago. I post on TikTok and social media short videos trying to tell a little bit of truth. And I pointed out that for the Taliban, you know, homosexuality is going to be illegal. They're going to execute gays, right? I mean, we're Western tolerant people here. People on the left supposedly say we're supposed to respect gay rights, and yet that's what the Taliban stands for. Their treatment of women is atrocious. They're going to be forced to cover themselves. They won't be able to go out in public alone. They won't be able to go to school or get educated. That men were going to be forced to wear beards and to pray five times a day. People don't remember the stories from the 90s. There was a story that I remember in particular that on Ramadan there was a man who had eaten a little something before sunset, which the Taliban thought was wrong, and they beat this man to death in front of a theater in the middle of Kabul, right? I mean, so this is how extreme the Taliban was. Anyway, I posted this video, and there are all these people commenting, oh, no, the Taliban's not like that anymore, and, oh, they're not doing this, they're not doing that. And I had to point out to people that just because they hadn't had the opportunity, the time, to implement their full extremist regime did not mean that they weren't going to implement it. And sure enough, they're going around now shutting down girls' schools, murdering teachers, they're, you know, hanging interpreters from helicopters. It's the same Taliban, right? And this guy, their new leader is just the same as Mullah Omar was, right? I mean, they're the same Taliban as the 90s. But a lot of people don't remember the 90s. And they've been living up in the hills and the mountains, hiding from U.S. forces all this time. President Trump almost had a peace deal with them where they were going to recognize the legitimate government that was elected by the Afghani people. But they decided to sit out the 2020 election. Figuring that if for some reason Trump should lose, that would create this opportunity for them. They would never have done this under Trump. They know what he would have done. He would have fought back. Instead, we tuck tail and we run. And, you know, talking about the larger implications, that's certainly going to be noticed in Moscow, in Beijing, in Tehran, in all these places around the world where bad guys are plotting against the United States.
Well, it's being an ex-Muslim, it's always, I guess, amazing to me when I hear about, oh, the new version is moderate and the new version is not radical. I'm like, there is no new version. There is no old version. There's just one version, the version that you read in the Quran. That's the only version. Those that you see at the bar who are drinking with you or their Rashida Talibs who are not wearing the hijab, they are going to be absolutely facing consequences if they ever live in a country that is ruled by Sharia. You can't count those. You can't think of those as representatives of Islam. And I'm not saying that just because I had a couple of bad memories as an ex-Muslim. No, I'm saying that because in Quran itself says those who do what they're doing are not Muslims. They are known as, you know, the ones doing fitna or corruption and division within Islamic society. So it is always a narrative that's been pushed forever, especially after September 11. But yes, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, IRGC, they all follow the same Quran. It's the same system. As you said, it just depends on, based on their own Quran, 47:35, it says, do not call for peace when you're superior in numbers, like right now, Taliban in Afghanistan. They have the control, so they're not going to be, quote-unquote, peaceful. They're going to do what they need to do. But sorry for this long rant of mine, but I have heard...
No, but you're right.
Isaac, from a lot of people, including Americans, that, well, okay, fine, but September 11 was Al-Qaeda. It wasn't Taliban. It had nothing to do with Taliban. You want to go ahead and elaborate on what it did have? Like.
Yeah, it absolutely did have to do with the Taliban. I've alluded to it several times. I mean, up in Jalalabad in the Hindu Kush Mountains, there's this training camp where Al-Qaeda was. In fact, we know the Clinton administration was ready to bomb it, and then they noticed that some Emirati prince was hanging out there, and they didn't want to kill him at the same time, but they were going to go after bin Laden after one of the terrorist attacks that he committed before. Because before 9/11, we had attacks in Saudi Arabia, we had attacks in Yemen on the USS Cole, we had attacks in Eastern Africa. The United States had been attacked many times by Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, and he was already a known entity. But our failure to respond effectively to those during the Clinton administration allowed Al-Qaeda to escalate. Of course, their training camp there in Afghanistan was a blessing for them. The Taliban supported them, protected them. The Taliban and the Pakistani intelligence services, who were hiding bin Laden right up until 2011, right? All these friends that he has among the so-called moderates, right? There they were, training in Afghanistan, helping the Taliban, right? Training the Taliban and offering them, buying them equipment and what have you, and the Taliban helping them by offering them protection and a place to train terrorists without consequences, right? And again, the Taliban went out and assassinated the leader of their opposition 2 days before 9/11. Okay, they knew that the defecation was about to hit the rotary device, right? They knew that something was about to go down, and so they assassinated the one person they thought who could lead effective on-the-ground opposition to the Taliban. The idea that somehow these two groups weren't in cahoots, that they weren't the same thing, it's nonsense. As you pointed out, I mean, it's all one chimera. It's one beast with many heads. Islamic State, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, they're all the same thing, right? And whether it's Mozambique or the Philippines or in Afghanistan or, of course, in the Gaza Strip, we're fighting essentially the same enemy. They call themselves different names, and they operate under the same agenda, the same heart beats, if you will, the same passion drives them to annihilate the Jews, to dominate the world, and to force people into this archaic, medieval Islamic lifestyle that they believe in.
And interesting enough, if anybody paid attention or studied September 11, the entire manifesto, including videos released by bin Laden himself and his minions, that the reason they attacked America was for the fact that America was supporting Israel, which, by the way, it always makes me wonder that do people realize since September 11 to today, very slowly and very gradually, the Democrat government, Democratic Party government of America has done their best to distance themselves and not literally be allies of Israel, which is one of the things that Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Hamas, Hezbollah, IRGC, every one of them, that's what they want. No support for Israel because they think if there is no support, then they can wipe Israel off the map, which is the end goal for them. I hate to repeatedly have to say this, but it is the truth, and I'm sure you can vouch for the fact that it is truth. That's what they all look for at the end of the day. But we got attacked. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you're 100% right. I mean, we got attacked because we support good guys, because we stand for freedom, and because we promote freedom and prosperity around the world. They don't want that. They don't want democracy. They don't want freedom. They don't want prosperity. They want their archaic lifestyle. And obviously they want they themselves, whoever it is, whatever head of the chimera, wants as much power as the individual leaders can get for themselves. It's all about power to them. They don't care about anything other than that. And they pursue that with a passion to the point where, 19 men were willing to fly planes into buildings and kill themselves, and hundreds of other people in the planes and thousands of other people in the various buildings in order to get what they want. And we're fighting these people, and here we as decent, civilized people who live our lives and just try to work and raise our children and what have you, we don't want to believe that there are bad guys like that in the world. It's hard to comprehend, but we have to pay attention. We have to recognize that if we don't stand up to these people, if we could have gone in and whacked Al-Qaeda before 9/11, right? We had the opportunity to, but we held back. If we don't stand up to these people, they will come to our homes, okay? They will blow up our buildings. They'll start blowing up our fast food restaurants and our cafes, and they'll do what they do to Israel here. I mean, you don't have any idea when you ride the bus and you're just not sure what's going to happen. You know, shortly after I returned from Israel for my stay there for a year, there was a bus that was blown up at the bus station that I usually got off at in Jerusalem. It becomes, you know, very personal. If I'd stayed a few months longer, I might have been on that bus. You know, this is the kind of thing that they try to create, this insecurity, this constant stress and tension that they're trying to murder you and your children and your families and destroy your freedom and your ability to live your life. It's scary.
But that's that, as you said, I don't think most people, it's hard to look at truth and reality when it's painful. It's hard to try to imagine. I have said this on many of my videos or live programs, that imagine having to leave the way people in Israel do, waking up every morning not knowing if you're going to see the night or not, not knowing if your children are safe, not knowing if your husband's going to come home or not. Are we really going to wait until then? Does it have to be in your backyard for you to tangibly understand it exists?
Yeah, the left today is trying to act as though what's happening in Afghanistan is contained, like it's just going to stay over there somehow. And that part, you know, they're trying to minimize their own failure. The disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan is so bad. And to put it in historical context, people have been comparing it a lot to the evacuation of Kabul to the evacuation of Saigon in 1975. That was another situation where the U.S. could have gone back in and driven the NVA out of South Vietnam. We had an agreement with Vietnam to do so if they invaded, but after Richard Nixon's resignation, Gerald Ford just didn't have the strength. The government didn't have the spine to do that, and so we lost. However, put that in its context, Vietnam was a brush fire in a larger Cold War that we were winning overall, right? So the Soviet Union was already dying. The Stalinist generation was dying off. They were already failing. Their economy was collapsing. No one believed in the Soviet Union anymore. And so it slowly died. So in that situation, we won for losing. We were very fortunate because the course of history was against the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union fell and collapsed. We're in a very different situation now. This isn't one brush fire in a larger Cold War that we're winning, okay? This is a major front of the war on terror, a war that we are losing, right? Iraq today is largely controlled by Iran. It's largely run by Shiite militant groups. The Taliban run Afghanistan.
Let me interrupt you for a second.
You know?
1 second.
Are we winning?
Let me ask you this. I have been asking this for too many years, and no one has given me the answer I could make sense out of. Why did we go to Iraq? What did Iraq have anything to do with September 11th? Anything? Why did we go there?
Maybe you're asking the wrong person, because when we decided to invade Iraq, I was one of those kids who went out and protested against it. That was a war that we shouldn't have fought. We didn't need to. And in my opinion, America should not choose wars of choice when we shouldn't. I mean, we declared war on Britain in 1812. It was a disaster, right? We should fight wars when we ourselves are attacked, when our interests are threatened. And this situation with Iraq in 2003, WMD. We knew that Saddam Hussein had a large amount of yellow cake uranium. We knew that he had chemical weapons. Dow Chemical sold them to him. I mean, we used to joke back then. Of course we know Saddam has chemical weapons. We have the receipts. There was a lot of shadow and cloak and dagger around the cause for going to war in Iraq, and it was a mistake. I mean, I'm not saying Saddam Hussein was a good guy. I'm not saying that he shouldn't have gone. And if his people had overthrown him and then invited us in, that would have been a different situation, or the UN or someone else. But the situation was there. There was no reason to go in. And what have we done? We've handed Iraq over to Iran. We've taken away the one counterweight, the one force that kept Iran in check. And now Iran and their proxies, which now includes half of Iraq, more than half of Iraq, they and their proxies have more tentacles, you know, out into the Middle East, right? They have more power. Basically, Iran controls everything from Syria and a significant power in Lebanon. They may end up running Lebanon soon if we're not careful. All the way over to Iraq and then to Iran itself. And then they have their proxies, the Houthi rebels in Yemen. They have Hamas. They have terrorist groups in Egypt and all over the Middle East that support their cause. So the best thing Donald Trump ever did over there was wax Soleimani to kill one of their top terrorist leaders. Soleimani was a terrible man, an evil man who deserved to die many times over, and getting rid of him scared the Iranian regime. Now that Biden's in office, they think they run the thing. You know, the whole Middle East is their oyster, as far as they're concerned.
Well, here's what I think. I think going to Iraq or picking the war with Iraq played the same role right now the mandate of vaccine is playing. It was a distraction because it was the whole point of we're fighting someone. But again, you look back, Iran, the regime of Iran had their hands involved with September 11. The hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Taliban were in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. So those were the three countries. If there was any retaliation, it should have been towards them. But they just decided, hey, we're just going to go to Iraq, so Americans are going to think we're fighting. We are retaliating. Right. And I guess back then, most people didn't bother to think, why are we retaliating against a country? Again, as an Iranian who actually, I grew up in the middle of Iran-Iraq war. I was born in 1983, so I faced the war. I remember the war. I'm not defending Saddam Hussein in any shape or form. I'm just saying, as you said, for example, in 2009, when people of Iran were trying to overthrow the regime and requested help from America, we didn't go in. It was an invitation, and we still said, no, we're not coming in. But when it came to Iraq, we just decided to be heroes and go in. And as you said, and I posted on my page, of course, we knew they have chemical weapons because we gave it to them when they were fighting Iran. So it was all a distraction. We literally destroyed, as you said, we handed it over to Iran. We destroyed a lot of lives, sacrificed a lot of our military members so we could pretend like we're defending our country.
It's sad. And, you know, Halliburton made great money over there supplying logistics and food. And so the Cheneys, the Bidens, and, these powerful families in Washington made good money. While we spilled sacred blood and spent our tax dollars and our great-great-grandchildren's tax dollars as well to fight a war we didn't have to fight. And this is the moral weight of what's going on now. But, I mean, again, look at it. We've spent a lot of money. We've lost a lot of lives. And what have we done? The Taliban is in control. They're stronger today than they were. They have all of our military equipment, which they are now selling to Iran. We have confirmed that U.S. forces in Erbil, in Iraq, in the Kurdish zone, had to fire at two American-made drones that were sent there by the Iranians that the Taliban captured in Afghanistan. The Taliban have use for some of this equipment, but they don't need it. They're going to sell it. They're going to make a killing selling our technology to Iran, to Al-Qaeda, to other terror groups, and to dissidents who seek the overthrow of the Sunni Arab governments, whatever you think of them. Like you mentioned, this, a lot of Saudis involved in 9/11, for sure. But I'd rather see the Saudis in charge of Saudi Arabia than Iran. You know, that wouldn't be a good thing. So this is the trouble we have, and that's where Israel comes into it, because those weapons that we've left behind are now going to threaten our closest allies, and the one country in the Middle East that really shares our democratic values.
Agreed. By the way, just a side note, as an Iranian, I will say that I have been saying it for almost 10 years now. If there is any regime government that needs to be taken out, it's Iran. The rest will be fine as long as we take the Iranian regime out of the formula. With that, Hezbollah and the rest of them.
But they're the evil that's behind most of it. Probably not, sadly.
Exactly.
The Obama administration tried to make Iran the kingpin of the Middle East. They wanted Iran to be a even a counterpoint to Israel, if you can believe it. But, you know, Iran is behind most of the violence in the Middle East. They're behind most of the chaos. If the Iranian regime fell, we'd finally have a victory in this war, and we'd start to be able to see real opportunities for peace. Once, you know, the Houthi rebels are not being supplied by Iran, they may actually come to the negotiating table and negotiate in good faith. Once Hamas is disarmed and weak and bankrupt because they're being supported by Iran, they have all kinds of weapons and power, there will be a possibility to talk about peace, which we can't talk about while people are shooting rockets at us. So Iran is the main antagonist in that whole region that is behind so much of the trouble. And you're right, if we got the snake in its lair, you know, take off the head, the whole rest of the body would die. And the Middle East would be not a peaceful place, but a much less dangerous, much less violent place.
Very true. But let's take the second half of this program to actually talk about how all of this is affecting Israel. I know you hinted at the weapons, but I think people need to understand what it means for Israel from our wrong reaction to September 11 all the way to today, to us just fleeing and running from Taliban and letting them have everything we let them have.
Yes. Well, so first of all, I mean, we all know that, you know, 9/11 was pulled off by the elders of Zion, and it was all part of the great Zionist plan to, you know, to invade Iraq and do all of that. So, you know, we should wonder why the Jewish lasers are not destroying the Taliban. I guess if we had the Jewish lasers, I guess we'd be using them, wouldn't we? You know, we get these crazy conspiracy theories. I just want to talk about for just a second here that all these people that said that, you know, well, Mossad was behind 9/11 because they wanted to get America involved in the war on terror, and Israel was manipulating the U.S. to invade Iraq. All of that's a bunch of nonsense. When the United States started to talk about invading Iraq, Ariel Sharon was prime minister in Israel, and the very first thing when he met with President Bush and with the Bush cabinet, he said, don't do it. America has no interest in getting involved in there. You're just going to lose a lot of people, blood and treasure, and it's not going to accomplish anything. Israel's security revolves around knowing what's going to happen next. The Israelis are very much about the reality of the Middle East, and they did not want the U.S. to become a wild card in the situation in Iraq, which we did, because, of course, we get tired of fighting over there, and we leave, and now Israel is left with a less secure situation. Just a few hundred miles, the Iraqi border is just a few hundred miles from Israel, right, across Jordan and Syria, and Syria is now a failed state. So there's not even the quote-unquote stability of a dictator, you know, between Israel and Iraq. Today we are seeing Lebanon disintegrate. They may devolve into a second civil war between Sunnis and Shiites, the original civil war mostly between Shiites and Christian population in Lebanon, which was cut in half through violence and murder, and also Christians being forced to flee Lebanon en masse. But Lebanon is becoming a failed state. So Lebanon's about to become another Syria, and that means another place run by Iran, right? Where Sunnis are going to be oppressed, Sunnis and the remaining Christians are going to be oppressed by the Shiite minority. Excuse me, they're going to be the dominant force. Jordan is hanging by a string, and this is the part that a lot of people don't know. One of the king's brothers was talking about a possible coup recently. There's a lot of weakness. A lot of people smell the weakness and the scent of death on the Hashemite kingdom. A lot of internal trouble. A lot of people in Jordan not happy with the monarchy. It's entirely possible, if Jordan doesn't play its cards right, that Jordan could be the next failed state, and they're right next to Israel. Now, the current Jordanian kingdom has a peace treaty with Israel, and they share water, and we get along relatively well. But if Jordan becomes a failed state, that's a big problem for Israel, because then right next door to Israel is two, now possibly three, chaotic failed state regions. Now, you think about, if you're a Jordanian dissident today, you can set up a camp in Afghanistan, get a bunch of your friends over there. There's nothing the Jordanian government can do about it. There's nothing that the U.S. or Israel or anyone who wants to maintain security in the Middle East can do about it. You can train. You can get weapons, high-tech weapons, guns, vehicles. You can come back to Jordan with an arsenal, right, thanks to the Iranians. We were just talking about Iran is perfectly happy to see to help these people. They can drive right through Iran and Iraq and Syria right into to Jordan and then overthrow the Jordanian government. Right, we are going to see more of this equipment. We are going to see more of the terrorists training in Afghanistan, and it's going to be disastrous. I don't have words to say how bad this is. They're also going to make another attempt, I think, at the Egyptian government of al-Sisi. Israel could end up once again surrounded, just like it was in 1967, by forces seeking genocide. You know, we've had a little bit of peace. We've had a little bit of stability. We have seen some change in the Middle East. The Arab governments slowly warming to Israel because they know, they've said Israel was the worst thing ever, but they know that Israel just wants to live in peace within Israel. So they're now seeking Israel as an ally because they know that Iran doesn't just want to be in Iran. Iran wants to control the whole Middle East, right? It could all blow up on us.
Well, if you think about it, Iran wants to control the entire, you know, planet Earth. If you let them, they want to control everybody. They just want to take it all. Sometimes when I talk about global caliphate, I feel like I need to make the differentiation between there's the global caliphate that the Sunnis are trying to achieve, which is through Islamic Jihad global caliphate. And then there's the global caliphate that Khomeini, the man who invaded my motherland, he has started that global caliphate of the Shia mullahs to be rulers of everyone, including Sunni Muslims. Now, they don't kill the Sunnis. They let them be second-class citizens. They kill the rest. Let me ask you this. Under the new government in Israel, how do you see things play out since Bibi Netanyahu is not in power or the prime minister? How do you see things play out on the worst or best case scenario?
Well, in my podcast, I went into great detail over the course of the whole election with the pros and cons of Bibi himself and the process of trying to of his seeking election again, the longest serving prime minister in Israeli history. And a lot of Israelis were just looking for change, tired of the same old, same old. But the way he was clinging to power was not looking good. Let's just say, if there's a bullet in his foot, it's he who shot himself. But Bibi was a strong leader when it came to security. And the one thing you can say about Netanyahu, he created a prosperous Israel and he created a secure Israel. And he still leads the opposition, so, you know, he could come back. One thing we say in Israeli politics, never say never, because in 1999, I just talked about this in my last episode. In 1999, when Bibi lost his direct election with Ehud Barak and left the office of prime minister, everyone said, oh, his career's finished, he's in disgrace, he'll never come back. 10 years later, he was back in office as prime minister. The new government is basically a conglomeration of all of Bibi Netanyahu's opponents, some right-wing parties, some very right-wing parties, like that led by Naftali Bennett, the current prime minister, and some left-wing parties, Labor, Meretz, and also Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid's party. Yair Lapid is largely seen and widely seen as the leader of Israel's left. And so the two together, the far right and the center left, have formed this coalition together. And Naftali Bennett will be prime minister for 2 years. And then he will rotate with Yair Lapid. But their government is strong to the extent that it is brought together opposing Bibi Netanyahu, and they're likely to hold together as long as he is in opposition. But they are untested. There's been a lot of violence in Gaza. There's been more rocket attacks. The you know, Hamas and the Iranian puppet masters behind them are trying to test the government and see how they'll respond. And so far, the government's been tough, not too weak, and they're holding the line. They know very well that if they're going to stay in office, they're going to have to provide the same kind of security situation that Bibi Netanyahu provided. And if they don't, then Netanyahu will be back in office. So I like to say, you know, right now Israel has Bibi in the back pocket if they need him. But I think the new government will be able to handle this going forward. Yes, I might prefer someone with a little bit more experience at this point who is tried and true and a known entity, given all the things that are happening. But the new government is holding on. I would like to note that the new government has a political party that supports the government called Ra'am. Ra'am is led by Mansour Abbas. He is a leader of the Israeli Arabs. And so, you know, so much for Israel being an apartheid state. The Arabs actually serve in the government. And Arab-Israeli interests, education, organized crime problems, housing issues, they're addressing those issues as members of the government. And it's long overdue. So it's a good thing that they're getting those issues addressed. But this is the point. Israel is the kind of country where if there's a political party that does not seek Israel's destruction, that is willing to join the government and address domestic issues with the government, we're happy to have them. So untested, untried, but experienced and capable, we'll see how it goes forward. I think that they are going to be tested very hard in the coming months by Iran, for sure.
I would say I have that feeling too, but let me ask you this. It's been many years, and I can't remember exactly it was 15 or 2015 or 16. I might be completely wrong, but, you know, Bibi Netanyahu had a full presentation showing how Iran is lying and, you know, their nuclear program is going forward and all that good of stuff. What has stopped Israel to this day to actually attack Iran? What's the hesitation?
Well, Israel has been attacking electronically and using inside agents to disrupt the nuclear program. It's been widely known that the Israelis don't want to if they don't have to. Under the Obama administration, the Iranian program was very much in its early stages. And so Bibi Netanyahu went to the UN, he went to before Congress, the Congress of the United States, and explained to everyone how the Iranians were lying and how the Obama deal was just going to give them a nuclear weapon in 10 years, right? I mean, what difference does it make it if they make it in 10 years or tomorrow? We can't allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. And Netanyahu was very straightforward. He's very honest. He told everybody exactly what was going on. And you had all these European leaders nodding along with him. You know, even it's frustrating because, you know, you look back and it's like he was so right. Everyone knew he was right, but they still, you know, when it came time to get in front of the cameras and the press and on the mic, you know, people like Nicolas Sarkozy, people like Angela Merkel, you know, they all kind of like, oh, you know, we want peace and we want a deal. And, you know, why don't you people just be honest and say you want Iranian oil? Right, because that's what Europe really wanted. The Obama administration had this strange idea that Iran was their answer to Islamic State, that Iran could defeat IS, that they could be trusted with the power that would give them, and that they could become an effective counterpoint to Israel, since obviously the Obama administration and the Biden administration as well are not great fans of Israel. They would have this ability to play teeter-totter, let's say, in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. It was a disaster. It has been a disaster. It is currently a disaster, and it's a terrible policy. One reason that Israel did not attack from 2017 to 2021 was Donald Trump. Donald Trump was a strong president. He kept Iran in check. He put the sanctions back on and made the regime hurt. And so Israel was willing to trust a strong president like Donald Trump that he would take action if need be. Today, Naftali Bennett has made some comments alluding to the possibility that Israel may go ahead and bomb Iran. Why would we have to do that? Because the U.S. is too weak to deal with the problem ourselves. It's also America's problem, but it may end up having to be Israel to take action because America is too weak to stand up to the Iranians. The Iranians are having a field day. So we'll see what happens. The Saudis are allowing Israel to use their airspace for commercial overflight into Bahrain and the UAE, two countries that have now made peace with Israel and normalized relations, the so-called Abraham Accords, very good steps taken by Donald Trump to foster peace. you know, and he was smart. He sent his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to the Middle East, and he went around the State Department and all of the usual players, right, who have a vested interest in the status quo. He went around all of them and talked to the leaders directly and found out that there was an opportunity for this step, and he took it. And, you know, the State Department and all those guys were against it because it's not how they do things, right? But we have a good thing going there. Israel could, in theory, send military aircraft over to the Gulf and attack Iran and bomb their nuclear sites. And with the technology Israel has, the new F-35, the Israeli version, the F-35I, the Adir, which is training and fitting out in Israel even now, it's a stealthy plane. The Iranians would have a heck of a time attacking it or trying to defend against it. Israel could go in. Israel also has submarines that can launch cruise missiles. There are a number of different ways that we could attack the nuclear facilities. And Israel's done this before. They did it in Iraq. If they have to, they'll do it again in Iran.
Well, you said something. I remember it was very recent when Prime Minister of Israel, I hope I don't butcher his name, Naftali, had a sit-down with Biden, and Biden was snoring as Naftali was talking. I can't express how embarrassed I felt at that moment. I'm like, no, this is not happening. Our president is not actually taking a power nap in the middle of an important meeting with Prime Minister of Israel. So I don't blame the government of Israel to think we have the weakest possible ever imagined government with a president or a man who actually sits there and take a nap. And that's my concern, I guess, or question is a better term to put on it. A few months ago, very much, Israel was almost there. They almost defeated Hamas, and the U.S. government, Biden handlers, requested a ceasefire, and Israel followed the ceasefire. Why?
This is the same game we play all the time, isn't it?
Exactly. It's like... I guess it creates this constant question in my head that they had the perfect reason to finish that pushback and almost, I'm not saying get rid of Hamas, but they could have pushed Hamas back for about 200 years to build back up. But a phone call from U.S., the government that nobody should even trust or listen to, says ceasefire, and Israel goes for ceasefire. Why? As you said, I completely understand under President Trump, I get it. But for the last 8 months of Biden administration, I feel like they had so many chances to do it, but then they didn't do it.
And this is the challenge that we always have. You know, when the Arabs are winning, they go out and talk about, you know, how they're defeating Israel and they're firing rockets and that kind of thing. And then when we go in and do some real damage, when we really hurt them, when they're on the run, then all of a sudden they scream, oh, ceasefire, they're picking on us, they're bombing us. We get this same game over and over again. And as I've said on the podcast many times, welcome to the game. We play this game over and over and over again with these people. Unfortunately, Israel maybe has become too comfortable with this game. But I do want to say in the last conflict, Bibi Netanyahu pulled a very – he and the IDF. I don't want to give him complete credit, but he and the IDF played a very careful game. They announced over Twitter that they were getting ready to make a ground incursion into the Gaza Strip, for those who may not have heard the news. And as a result, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all these terrorist groups sent their fighters down into what we call the Gaza Metro. There are all these underground tunnels. The European Union gave them a bunch of concrete years ago to build new housing, and instead they built all these underground tunnels to use for attacking Israel. So they sent a whole bunch of their men down into those tunnels. And instead of making a ground incursion, the Israeli Air Force flew over and dropped bunker buster bombs, bombs that penetrate deep into the ground and blew up these tunnels and killed literally thousands of these Hamas fighters. The Hamas has tried to keep it quiet. Everyone's tried not to talk about it. But Hamas was really deeply injured. And when you say they were on the run, and I mean, you're right, they were hurt badly. And yes, we could have gone and finished them off, but as with all things, you know, the as soon as they're really hurt, as soon as they're injured, then they cry and scream like a baby and say, oh, we need a ceasefire, we need help. And when the U.S. calls Israel and asks for restraint, you know, Hamas is never called upon to end the terror or to show restraint, but we're always called upon to show restraint. And so our own morality defeats us, and thus, you know, we back off when we should have gone in for the kill. And a lot of people on the Israeli right were upset with Bibi Netanyahu that he did not go in for the kill. They still, a lot of people, those people still prefer him to the current government. But we could have gone in for the kill and done some real serious damage to Hamas. Now, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid is trying to do the sort of carrot and the stick thing. We'll offer greater economic prosperity in exchange for security. I don't know that that's going to work. Natan Sharansky, the Russian refusenik, he proposed something like this years ago, although he was mostly talking about Judea and Samaria, where the Palestinian Authority is in charge, the less malignant of the two cancers, right? Listen to my last episode and you'll get the reference. But we have in this situation always that when we're about to win, they cry foul and we stop. And, you know, we go back and forth, round and around, and then Hamas survives to fight another day, and it's sickening. You know, we need to go in there and we need to finish them off. We'll see what happens. But the usual game turned out very badly for Hamas because they lost a lot of fighters and they were in very bad shape. Now, of course, Iran is going to supply them with more money, more weapons, and possibly with some of our American equipment. Israelis could be facing some very nasty American-made weapons in the future when dealing with Hamas.
Agreed, and that's the thing. When I hear anyone talk about BDS, I kind of don't have words to communicate with them because I just keep thinking, like, are you just that delusional or are you just glued to mainstream media that you think that Israel is the problem, that you don't understand the money that America has given, American government has funded terrorism, Islamic terrorism in Middle East for way too long under too many administrations, and most recently with definitely $85 billion in weaponry. And again, I repeatedly tell people, this isn't just about the weapons. It's the fact that now they have access to duplicate and replicate the science behind those weapons. That's the bigger price than the actual weapon itself. And they have, 16,000 highest possible technology night goggles? That right there is way more scary than piles of cash that Obama gave to Iran's regime. But as you said, yeah, Not many people are paying enough attention.
Yeah, and that's always the sad thing. America has this long history of supporting regimes that want to destroy us, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who made the world safe for communism in World War II. You know, we will give money to the Iranians. There was a plan that the Palestinian Authority was going to hold elections. Mahmoud Abbas is very unpopular there. He faced elections once back in 2005, and he was elected to a four-year term, and there haven't been any further elections, right? He's been in office for all these years since then, you know, almost two decades now, and no elections. So he had scheduled elections, and then he called them off. And there were all these headlines out there. Abbas faces isolation, diplomatic isolation for calling off elections. The same time he called off elections, the Biden administration promised $250 million to the Palestinian Authority. So I joked on my podcast. You can go back and listen to the episode. I don't remember the number offhand. But, you know, I said, yeah, Abbas is feeling really alienated right now, really isolated, 250 million times over. You know what I mean? Because we talk about, like, we want democracy, and we talk about, well, we want peace, but then we give money and weapons to these evil people who will then turn them on us and on our allies. And then we get people over here who turn into a conspiracy theory the fact that the U.S. gives a modest amount of military aid to Israel, right? Like $4 billion a year compared to $85 billion in American military equipment that the Taliban just got. And Israel spends that money buying American-made equipment. The only difference between that being spent on the U.S. military and being spent on the IDF is that ultimately the IDF is the end user, right? But it's still American jobs, okay? And what do we get for that? We get a strong ally, great economic ties with Israel, and it's the one country in the Middle East that actually likes America. You know, I could not believe, just I'd heard, but when I got there, I was just amazed how many people were just, thank you, we love America. It's the only country in the Middle East that celebrates the 4th of July. Israel has the only 9/11 memorial in the world outside the United States that honors the names of all of the victims of 9/11. Israel is a country that loves the U.S., that supports our values and lives by them. And we are doing everything we can to undermine Israel right now, and it's sickening.
It is, and I think it kind of, as we come to the end of this program, I want to conclude here and get your thoughts on it. It gets more sickening to me when I see the self-hating Jew liberals cooperating and sponsoring care seminars and Linda Sarsour's and, you know, all of these anti-Semite American-hating people in America. What's wrong with them, Isaac? Why do they do this?
You know, Dennis Prager points out all the time that half the people in America who call themselves Jews are really secular leftists, basically communists, who don't want to call themselves white. They just don't want to admit that they're, you know, not member of a minority. But they really aren't Jews. They aren't really connected to Judaism. At the same time, I don't know. I mean, the problem is, for so long, American Jews have followed this path to secular culture and integration, and we've allowed the left to spew poison in our ears. I remember in college, it wasn't as bad for me then as it is for Jews in college now, but there was this distinct intimidation. There was an effort to make me feel guilty for being a Jew, first of all, and for being a Zionist, a supporter of Israel, second. And in college, I wasn't even all that as passionate about Israel as I am today. Going to Israel taught me a lot of things and opened my eyes. So, you know, the effort to destroy the Jew is disgusting. And it is done so much more insidiously by the left today than it was done by Hitler. Because Hitler just put Jewish people in gas chambers and burned the bodies. Okay, but now they are murdering the Jew without killing the body. They're destroying the Jewishness of the Jew. They're destroying our support for our homeland. And so there are all these people, they're guilty for being Jewish. They're ashamed of their heritage. They're always saying Israel's all these horrible things. And when you point facts, when you bring facts to them and show them that it's a different way, they just, like all the other Marxists and leftists, they just get angry, throw a temper tantrum because they don't like your facts, right? But I have to say, since I've been out pushing on social media, I've had a campaign. You can watch it on the Inside Israel News Facebook page. I post the videos there. They're also on TikTok, Instagram Reels, and YouTube. But I've been posting these short videos, just exposing one fact at a time, destroying one lie at a time, and I've had an incredible response. And I've been surprised how many of my fellow Jews have liked, commented, followed, who have echoed my points, who have brought up new points that I hadn't thought of, and we're slowly rising to the occasion to stand up to this. If we don't, no one will stand up for us, unfortunately.
Perfectly said. Thank you so much, Isaac, for being with us today. I hope we get to bring you back and talk more because at least I know most of my audience are, they all love Israel, they stand by Israel, and they do like to get educated on the situation, either inside Israel or with anything that's related to Israel in America. So thank you so much for your time, and look forward to having you back on again.
Thank you, Annie. Appreciate it. And check out Inside Israel News. It's a good time.
Absolutely. To our lovely audience who stayed with us until now, we appreciate you very much. Please remember to share this episode. Everybody needs to know. Well, that's what we do. We tell the truth. We bring facts to the table because at the end of the day, this is an info war. People are being misinformed, and it's our job to give them the correct information. Check out liveuptofreedom.com, and don't forget to go find Inside Israel News on TikTok, Facebook, everywhere. Just put it on, find it, follow Isaac, and get informed. Stay safe, and I will talk to you all next time. Goodbye.